Relentless, laser-like focus, and stoic are just a few words that describe our next guest today. Having grown up with his mother in the north of England in abject poverty, Bob Holt had a burning desire to succeed. And succeed he did. From being CEO of Tottenham Hotspurs in his 30s and 55 bagging mirrors, to being helicoptered in to save Revolution Beauty and buying 50 companies in the period of 18 months, Bob Holt has seen more in his business career than most of us would see in many lifetimes. This relentless energy spans well beyond business, though, and much of Bob's recent time has been spent on charity work like his foundation, the Footprints Foundation. This was a really inspiring episode for me. So sit back, relax, and we hope you enjoy it. Getting money, get money. One for the money. $350 Swiss. Zurich, 23. Two for the show. Two and eight sold. Get it, get ready, and board us. Go! Welcome to Mavericks.
So, Bob, thank you so much for coming on. You grew up in the north of England with your late mother in abject poverty. You had a burning desire to get away from your humble start. Your father was a military man. Your mother had a grocer just outside Manchester. Did you have a happy or relatively normal childhood?
Mine was very normal. My, as I said, my mother, yes, she started probably at the very bottom of society. She had the burning desire to get on. My father, as I said, yes, military. But look, I had a very happy childhood. My parents worked hard. My father worked for my mother. There was never any doubt about that. And, great. No problems at all. My father didn't see my success because he died when I was in my early 30s. So, in reality, as ever, people don't really, well, most people
didn't used to. I think things are different now.
Make their real money till they're in their 40s and sometimes later, but often. Yeah, so for me, great time. My mother only died 12 years ago, so.
Was she growing up, was she the head of family? Was she the kind of inspiration to you?
I think my mother was deaf, so she wasn't a typical sort of dominant northern housewife that you could expect. She went about her business she's a very, very good businesswoman. My brother had a shop that my parents gave him, and he was, love him to death, sadly no longer with us either. He wasn't a business person at all. So I remember fondly my mother ringing my brother up, telling him, got to be here the following day to go to particular where to buy this, that, and t'other. Oh, well, I'm not sure, mother. No, no, Fred, you're having it, sort of thing. So she was a strong character.
How did the grocery shop come about? Did she just go at it alone?
I think, and again, you look back on these things, don't you, with rose-tinted glasses. I was a subject of my mother meeting my father when she was married to somebody else. So I think, in quotes, I suppose my mother would say I was a love child, all that nonsense. Because, of course, it wasn't sex in the 1950s, it was love. In reality, I think what my mother wanted was, although she'd worked hard, she wanted to be around when I was around from school and all that. So she bought a shop. And the shop we lived above the shop, so, it was a cosy environment. The first one was on a very busy main road near a school. So, it was a really happy time. But
did it grow from there, or was it?
Oh, yeah. My dad didn't work in the shop then. He had a job. And then when he got the second shop, my dad left and then obviously ran that, but always worked for my mother. I often get asked, though, what did your father do for a living? Because they assume something similar to what I do. I said, well, he worked for my mother. And that tends to bring a laugh for people.
Yeah, and then, so were you a relatively normal kid? You play sport? Did we?
Yeah.
Academic?
I had aspirations. No, certainly wasn't academic. I had aspirations to be a footballer. I had trials when I was 15. And very clearly, even I knew that I wasn't good enough. But you hang on to a dream. I remember playing a trial at Bury, and my father came up to me as I'm coming off at half-time to go up the tunnel playing on Gig Lane, Bury's pitch. And my father came over and said to me, you're the worst player on the pitch. And I saw parents of kids, build them up. Jimmy, you're great. Jimmy, you're doing this. My father was always a realist. And he was a very, if I said military, he was a very, very quiet man. So when he spoke, he meant it as a sort of inspiration. You're the worst player in the park. Brackets, you need to do something differently.
Yeah.
And I was fired at 15. I saw that. It didn't throw me off edge. So I knew that. Clearly, I wasn't good enough. And so, therefore, I had to do something else. And I left school early and I went to be an office boy.
Were you interested in business at the time or not really?
Really? And I think I wanted to work in an office, and I started working in an office. And I remember, although it's well over 50 years ago, you know, going for an interview, and the guy who interviewed me, who actually became a big mentor of mine, he was more interested about my football career and where I played and what position did I play and what did I do. Well, by the way, start tomorrow. And come on, these are different times, aren't they? So I was office boy, day one, you know, sharpen these pencils, you know, add up these numbers. I started working October 1970, and I remember it for the things I'll say now. And in February 71, that most of you people have never heard of, you know, the company went to decimalisation, and the office manager said to me, and I was 16 years of age, and the office manager said to me, oh, Robert, you're the one who's most recently been at school. Can you talk to all the staff about this decimalisation stuff? And at the time, the government gave out coins, i.e. a set of the coins that were about to be distributed. So I had to stand there in front of all these older people telling them about. And I said something along the lines of, I can remember I said something along the lines of, well, I think it's easier to count to 10 than it is to count to 12. So, yeah, but how much is a penny? Well, it's 2.4p. How's that working? Sorry, 2p coin is 2.4, but what is all that? So it was quite interesting. Anyway, and from there, I did some night school, some day release, got a few exams, and I got the taste for it, I suppose. And, you know, as I say, I had a desire to get on. But my mother had always said to me, from whatever I chose to do, she'd always said, if you work hard, you've got a chance of doing something. If you don't work hard, you've probably not got a chance. So it's up to you, you know, work hard enough. And of course, I'm in an environment where my parents work 7 days a week, at least 12, 14 hours a day. So this wasn't an environment where, you know, you were sat on your backside. And, you know, and again, you probably never grew up in a grocery corner shop. If you've seen the program Open All Hours, that was our shop. So even when you've closed, you know, you get a knock on the door because somebody's forgotten their fire lighters. But, you know, if your parents are eating and the doorbell goes, you get up and you serve. Yeah. You know, so look. You know. So I think my mother gave me the greatest skill of hard work. And now in my late 60s, I still work harder than most people.
The first big break, if I'm not mistaken, came from a situation in which you were headhunted by Michael Ashcroft, now Lord Ashcroft. How did that come about? What happened?
Yeah, I was working in the cleaning industry. It was my first foray into the service sector, and I was working for a business based in Manchester, where I was living, obviously, at the time, but headquartered in Bristol. And I was a finance guy, and it was incredibly hard work, because it was a sector one, firstly, that was fairly unprofessional, in where a management team had put together a very, very capable senior management team. I wasn't involved in that senior management team, but they were very, very bright people, very good, and they were looking to professionalise that sector, and they did. And so therefore, I was very, very busy. And, you know, I remember one year I worked, I think, 364 days at least, you know. Again, as I say, there were different times. This is the early 80s. And I did 3 great years there. My career sort of took off in that 3 years, managing a finance department and, you know, and trying to contribute to a senior management team at the time. And one of the guys who worked with me in that management team left and joined Michael Ashcroft. And he initially went to work in the Midlands for Michael. And then an opportunity came up for him to go out. They had just bought, I don't know, it was their first acquisition overseas.
This Hawley's?
Hawley's. Yeah. Hawley. I think it may well have been their first overseas.
It was a £250,000 market cap at the time.
Nothing. But Michael quickly grew it. And my friend Martin, he got sent out to the US, to Atlanta, to head up the finance function of Oxford Services that they'd bought at Atlanta. And rather surprising. So again, anyway, he'd been there a few months, and he said, why don't you come over for a holiday and have a you know, see what we do over here and blah, blah, blah. So I'd never gone on a business trip to the US before. I'm not even sure whether I'd been to the US before at that point. This is 1984, I think. Anyway, off I went, and I came back and took a phone call from a guy I'd known who was a sort of jack of all trades, part of which was a headhunter. And he said, I think the opening gambit was, how would you like to go and work in America? And I said, well, not really. And I've just come back from there, actually. I'm not sure it's for me. Sorry, what do you mean? You just go, so and I said, somebody wants you to consider going out and heading up their business in the US as a VP of the startup, listed company in the UK, blah, blah, blah. They're about to make an acquisition. They want you to go in, be finance guy and that, and then build a platform. I'm not sure it's for me. Who is it? He said, I can't tell. I said, well, bye. Put the phone in. He rang me back about an hour later, so it's Tony Berry. And Tony Berry at the time was the darling of the city. He had built a Blue Arrow bought it privately, took it onto USM, and was the darling of the city.
He was chairman of Tottenham PLC.
He was a non-exec of Tottenham later, not then. Right. But he was chairman and chief exec, I think, of Blue Arrow at the time. As I said, it was darling of the USM, and I went to meet Tony, and again, because of my sporting background, I played cricket as well as football. Tony had been Middlesex cricketer, Middlesex twos and Tottenham twos. You know, he played Tottenham reserves, I think. And so again, you know when you know the mentality of people that you're talking to.
Yeah.
It's an easy conversation. And he said to me, "Look, I need to build a platform in the US. You have been recommended to me. I know you and I can get on, and I can see that you and I will get on. Would you consider going out to the US?" Well, I'm living in Oldham at the time, you know, where I've been brought up. So moving from Oldham to Boston and Manhattan was quite a change. And I'd no recruitment experience. What he was about to buy, Tony, was a cleaning business, which I knew inside out. Cut a very long story short, I went out to the US. And if you think about it now, you know, just amazing, really. So within about 3 or 4 months, Ashcroft, who was quite close to Tony Berry, said, that business you bought in Boston, brackets, that Bob is currently running, we'd like to buy it. So Tony said, well, you know, Bob, he used to work for you, so, you know, suggest you get David Bates, my old boss at Aldi Group, to speak to Bob. And Bates came on, and you know, David was a very, very bright man, very good, capable, came on, said, da 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 da, I believe we're buying the business. I said, no, you're not. What do you mean? We're not? I said, no, you're not buying the business. It's not for sale. No. Tony and Michael have agreed. Okay, what they've agreed. I've just moved over here, it's a separate country. It's not for sale. Thanks very much. Bye. Of course, what I was doing was negotiating, wasn't I?
Yeah.
But it was quite ironic that I'm negotiating with my new boss against my old boss. You can imagine.
So, but when you joined Lord Ashcroft, I read a stat. I don't know if this is totally true, but 50 acquisitions in 18 months.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that must have been like
the UK.
Baptism of fire.
Yeah, that was in the UK. Yeah, yeah. So that was interesting. Yeah, baptism of fire and no time just to settle in what you got. But Michael was intent on growing the business, and that was fine. And it clearly worked for him, hasn't it? And it did work for him. But yes, it was a baptism of fire.
We had a previous guest, and they said that if they look at their kind of 50-year career, they learned 90% of everything they learned in those first 5 years. Can you kind of find similarities in that, or not really? Is the kind of progress been quite linear, do you think?
Oh, I think probably not 90%, but I had world-class MBA, international MBA experience from 1983-84 to 1988. So in that 5 years, I did more than most people have ever dreamed of. And I made lots of acquisitions. And I think, again, I've gone into print and reporting earlier that, you know, when people tell me now they bought this business, isn't going very well, I said, well, I'm surprised you're surprised, because I don't know, 100 businesses or over 100 businesses, and I still make mistakes. So why are you surprised in your first one it's not gone well? Because, of course, you know, it doesn't always go well. And, you know, no matter how much DD you do, there are always changes. But, yeah, great experience. And again, the one very clear message is I would not be sat here now doing this if I'd not worked for Michael Ashcroft and Tony Berry. That there is no doubt.
So you spent a couple of years in the US.
Yep.
Blue Arrow, it ended it ended colourfully. Is that?
Oh yeah, yeah, it did it. Yeah, of course I was on the Mayor board, so I was immune to city criticism almost. But yeah, so Tony. So then we bought Manpower. You forget that, and then had the largest ever cash call in the city of London, i.e. before privatisation, 880 million cash call, 1988, whatever it was. And I think at the time people were blaming Blue Hour for creating the crash. So that happened. Anybody who was close to Tony got offered the opportunity to go and build their career elsewhere, which I was. And Tottenham came along and offered me a job as chief exec, first chief exec they'd ever had.
You must have been mid-30s?
Oh, yeah, I was a lot younger than that, I think. So that, I'd be 34, 35, yeah. 34, I think. Again, an interesting experience. I think Tottenham were capitalised at 11 million at the time, when you think about it. And Irving Scholar, who was major shareholder, chairman of the football club, very much was a visionary. And I, Irving has been criticised over the years for things he's done. One thing I would admire him for, he never took a penny out of the club. So whenever he went to a match internationally, overseas, away, he never charged the club a penny. Quite the opposite. He was always a massive supporter, which I assume he still is. So I had admiration for him. But it was clearly A, not right for me, and B, that they hadn't got the financial structure right. So I resigned. 88, I think.
89. And when you were brought in, was that a kind of cleaning up job, tidying up the balance sheet?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. How did you find it when you...
Well, they bought a collection of businesses which were totally outside the structure. So although it was a leisure group, they bought a ladies' knitwear business. They had the Hummel distributorship. They had a publishing business. And just cleaning them up, really. And of course, they didn't have the balance sheet to support cleaning them up. So it was difficult. So you had to go and negotiate with Hummel in Denmark. I've just returned from Copenhagen this last weekend. So, it was that brought fond memories for my first ever trip to Copenhagen, probably 1987 or 8. And it was difficult times because the board was divided. They didn't have the finances. They just changed bankers changed bankers. They then worked against the agreement they had with the bank and went to bought Gascoigne without the money to pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. So I took the view, along with the broker. The broker resigned on the back of me resigning, BZW as it was then. And then what was I doing? I was a young man, 30-odd. You had two kids, I think.
Were you the youngest member of the board at Tottenham?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
What was that like? Were there raised eyebrows?
No, no.
Did you feel...
No, not at all, no. The reason, what had happened was, Tony had said he had said to the Blue Arrow board, Tottenham board, sorry, that he would sort out the financing on the East Stand. They were building a new East Stand with executive box in it. It's £3.5 million. All right, times were different. And Tony had sort of said, I'll sort that out. Tony had then become embroiled in his own problems at Blue Arrow, et cetera, et cetera. So he wasn't, in quotes, in a position to do it. And he must have said to me, go in and try and sort it out with Tottenham. Because I was the pickup boy. I picked up all the bits and pieces that were non-core and bubble sort them out, I think. And we came up with a scheme, which was a fantastic scheme for us at Blue Arrow. Not a great scheme for Tottenham. And it wasn't me, it was... senior partner Pete's came up with it. It's a brilliant scheme, which effectively was every time you sell a box, we get a commitment drawdown on that and we reduce our guarantee. So we guaranteed the bill. It was a great scheme. And on the back of that, they said, look, how's this guy, this young guy, come up with a scheme which has basically outmaneuvered us property people, because they were predominantly property people. It wasn't me, I could assure you. Anyway, so that was that. So I got involved and, it wasn't pleasant times. I think I've very rarely underestimated things in my life. That was one I underestimated. Underestimated the impact. If I wanted to be, I was front page and back page news. So I was back page news because of the football.
Yeah.
Business, front page as well, if I wanted to. And that has never been my desire. I've always preferred to let the numbers do the talking and get on with it. Yeah. So it wasn't a pleasant time. Yeah. So then I had to revert to what I knew, and my friends had formed Mighty.
Yes.
And so therefore asked me to get involved.
Management incentive through invested equity, is that?
Investment.
Yeah, equity, right?
Yeah. And I had been their finance guy in Manchester in the cleaning thing. So that was connection. I didn't really feel I wanted to go and work for somebody because, you know, in quotes, I'd been all right. I'd done all right for a few years, made a few quid. But anyway, I did, and I started doing a day a week. So the problem went from a day a week became 2 days a week, 2 days a week became 3 days a week, and suddenly I'm involved. And I ran the maintenance business for a couple of years. And I got very well rewarded because I took equity from them rather than, they bought my consultancy business off me for equity. So rather than wages, I worked for equity, which is something that I've done since. And the mighty share price reacted very favorably, did very well, so I did very well. And I stepped out of it at the end of 95. And I literally, at the end of 95, I found, or it found me, I can't remember which, Mears, which is a small private business looking.
Yes. You got a call from Grant Thornton. In Cheltenham.
Yeah, Cheltenham. And it was rather odd because I just assumed Grant Thornton's, it was a national M&A business. I didn't realise it was 20 miles down the road in Gloucestershire. Cut a very long story short, this would be this time of year, probably week before this, mid-December. Mike, who owned it, was going away for Christmas. I was going away for Christmas. So we arranged to meet on 5th, 6th, 7th of January. What we didn't realise until we'd come back on the 5th, 6th, 7th of January, we'd both been in exactly the same place in Spain with our kids playing in the same playground. Amazing. Anyway, so Mike and I, again, had from minute one, I think, he would tell you jokingly a different story, but we got on, and Mike was going through a very difficult time, I think, in terms of he'd built a very successful little business and he'd seen some things going wrong.
Yes.
So Mike said, look, I'll sell you to Hartford net asset value, 500 grand. I said, well, I'm not going to buy set assets because it's probably not worth net asset value, Mike, but I'll give you 50 grand for 25%. I'll come in and we'll take it public. How can we do that? Well, AIM had just started a year before. On the assumption the numbers are, as you say, they will be.
This must have been 96.
96. This is Feb 96.
Yeah.
So he leant across the table, said, Dan, see you tomorrow. And it was that simple. Went in the following day. Mike's a great operator, still is a great operator. And it was, you get out there and operate the business, Mike, and I'll sort everything else out.
So when you kind of came on board that first day, business is doing kind of 9-ish million top line, 100K bottom line.
Yeah, something like that.
Why was he struggling so much? What was happening?
Well, I know exactly why. He'd stepped out of his comfort zone. Until then, he'd made $250,000 and as a small private business, lived quite well out of it. But he always managed it very close to his heart. He'd meet the guys who ran Gloucester or ran something just over the water into Wales or ran something in 20 miles away. They meet up in the pub, you come in at 5 o'clock, drains up, you come in at 6 o'clock, drains up, you come in at 7 o'clock, done. He got business over in South Kent, and of course he couldn't manage it as he'd always managed before, so he panicked a bit, and he lost control of certain things. And anyway, so...
He'd taken on a bit of debt as well, didn't he, for the first time?
For the first time, he'd started using debt, and I think he slightly panicked. Because, you know, he saw, I think, the classic house of cards. His parents lived in the cottage behind the offices. He was guaranteeing the debt, et cetera, et cetera. But it became very evident very quickly. I didn't know this at the time, of course, but within weeks, it got sorted. Debt became cash. Not making money became profitable. We'd made, I think, so this was February. So in the June numbers, we'd made a couple hundred grand. And I said to Mike, we can float on the back of these interims. So we went, I hopped myself around with my round advisors, and eventually we got to a team who wanted to float us. One of my great friends, then and still is, Ian Kerry, and now Seneca, floated us. And we floated in October of that year, valuation 3.6 million. And in those days, I think I used to be quite good at making things boring. And I meant, you know, let's do the work. Let's invoice it and let's make sure we get paid. And it was exactly that. So it was nothing more than that.
Did you find, because we had, again, kind of referring to another guest again, but his kind of transition from bigger business to smaller business, the one thing that became absolutely, you know, couldn't be clearer was cash flow, right? Actually getting that cash. Is that, do you recognize?
Absolutely. There's nothing more important. There is nothing else. Without that, you don't survive. And again, you know, Mike had a good little business, but it just needed somebody like me to come in and know, have we invoiced it right? Perhaps wrong order. Let's not make this happen again, guys. Do we understand each other? So just getting that process going. And then after, so we floated at 3.6 million, October 96. And I kept my head down. I can't remember when we made our first proper acquisition. I think it was 99 or a couple of businesses. And that was a transformation, really, because we bought a business substantially bigger than us called Hayden. And Hayden, H-A-Y-D-O-N, had some little jewels in it that the people who owned it didn't realise. We got lucky in the nicest way. And we were off on it. And that share price had only grown 30%, which I was very happy with, going from 10p to 13p. And at that point, it was before then, Mike decided, the announcement was they were going to change the rules on CGT, where you had to, at that time, spend 3 tax years out of the country. And they were going to change that to 5 tax years out of the country. And in those days, and I think it's the same now, as long as you left on, say, the 30th of March, which is 1 tax year, and stayed away from the 5th of April, from the 6th of April to the 5th of April, another tax year, that was another tax year. And then as long as you didn't come back until, say, April the 10th, you've done 3 tax years.
Yeah.
And it might be about 380 days. So not the end of the world. Mike sold his house. We sold his stock. He went offshore. And as I say, we are as strong now as friends then. Rather amazingly, if you work out what, you know, I stayed along and made substantially more out of the business than Mike ever did. But you know, I think we spoke yesterday or the day before about some nonsense that we were involved in.
On the day of the listing, did he not slide over an envelope with your original $50,000 back? So you were in, you know, Mears at this stage for nothing.
Not from the tax office, are you? Yes, of course he did. Yeah. So I had originally agreed to give Mike $50,000 for 25%, and on the day of the float, he gave me my $50,000 back. And that is the measure of the man. He said, you know, in the nicest way, he'd have got nothing without me. So that's kind. So yeah, he gave me my $50,000 back. So my entry cost of Mears was zero. I got a clear option on 25%, and off we went. And again, did a couple of acquisitions, Tiddlers, and then a couple of ones a bit bigger. But what we were able to do very quickly, my finance director from Mighty came to join me, David Robertson, who was excellent, tight Scotsman, excellent finance director. David came on board, probably half his salary from Mighty, but with opportunity to earn and quite a bit on options. And he was brilliant because he just came in and made everything seriously boring. And I was then able to, I think, go out and build the business. David Miles, who was my operator in Mighty, joined me within a few weeks of me floating. No, within a few weeks of me getting involved in Mears. And David's a brilliant operator, still is, and has run Mears on his own for the last 10 years as chief exec. Brilliant operator. So, I built a good management team. And, you know, I, in the early days, well, for most of the time, I used to say to these people, don't worry that the press pick up it's Bob Holt's Mears, because the moment anything goes wrong, it'll be Bob Holt's useless or whatever it is. So don't worry about it. It doesn't say, you know, but we all know it's a team, and they all made a fortune. So
it was the best performing AIM share over a 5 and 10 year period.
Yeah, it was quite surprising.
And you got out. Was it £5?
Something like that. Yeah.
I mean, they're quite incredible. What with those kind of early days? Did you ever have days where it felt, you know, it was kind of scaled? Because it grew pretty quickly. Was it scaling out of control? Was the growth quite linear?
Or quite the opposite, really.
Really?
And again, if the story is ever written on Mears, which it won't be, we professionalised the way those services were procured in the public sector. Until we were there selling on value, it was cheapest gets it. You know, Thatcher's CCT, compulsory competitive tendering, I cheapest price gets. Blair then introduced best value. So what I had always done, and I still do it now, is I will hear somebody is coming on the market or somebody wants to look at me and interview. I'll interview them for several reasons, not least of which is I get to find out what's happening in the competition. And not only that, when you then get somebody in front of you say, I really want this person. The great strength of Mears was, and still is to this day, is long visibility of future orders. So although we may not have a job today for Fred, we know we're likely to have a job for Fred tomorrow. So the ability to bring Fred on board early and then introduce him to a potential client where a contract is coming up in a year's time. And don't forget, the average size of his contract in me is a 10, 15, 20 million a year and more. So here's Fred, he'll be running your contract if we're successful. And a client would say, yeah, well, we know that Fred, no, Fred hasn't got a job in my organization. In fact, I'll lend you Fred to go throughout the process if you'd like him here. So you can have Fred today. Very powerful. And then we always knew that Fred was available and put Fred in when we won it. So we were hugely successful and very, very powerful message. And you're all a bit young to remember, you know, how they used to, the strap line used to be for IBM. When IBM were dominated the box market
on computers,
the strap line used to be, can you afford not to buy IBM? Can you afford not to buy IBM? So the competition will be cheaper. You can go to it. Can you afford not? And that was a messaging I always left our people with. Get them to think, can they afford not to buy from Mears? Because you're going to guarantee certain standards, and if not, you won't charge them. Can they afford not to? So they can go to somebody else and get and pay 90p but get 50p of value, or they can come to us and pay a pound and get a pound of value. Come on, guys, it shouldn't be too difficult to sell. You're talking big budget. So it was a difficult sell. Anyway, we got that.
Did your involvement kind of wane towards the latter half of kind of your time with Mears, or was it?
It changed, yeah, of course it changed. In the early days, I was head cook, bottle washer, and, you know, going out buying the bottles and making sure they were right. Latterly, and then you've got your management team who take over. So at the end of my reign, I was doing next to nothing. Because you don't, you know, when I handed the reins as chief exec to David, so I stepped down as chief exec initially, and I don't know when that would be, but it would be at least 5 or 6 years before I stepped out of the business. I've never been a believer of hiring somebody and doing the job for them. You know, you're paying them a lot of money. Let them get on with it. Give them the support you need. So David runs a business completely different than I do. So what? He's in the position. I can't say, oh, David, I wouldn't do it like that. Well, why did you pick David then? Because let him get on with it. Yes, of course, if there's something fundamental, do you think that was right? But so David ran the business different, and they've been equally as successful since I stepped down as chief executive, then chairman. Certainly grown it substantially. Some of the areas they've grown into, the city hasn't welcomed, and so therefore the share price has suffered. But it's a great business with some very, very good and capable people. And I was asked recently, you know, do you miss Mears? No, I don't miss Mears at all. But I'd love to have a go at it now and get people together, and there'd be a few, oh, dear me. But yeah, it's a good business. And I'm very proud of what the management team did.
Yeah, yeah. So after Mears, what happened? What came next?
Well, before Mears, I was asked to go in and sort out a Mears 2, a version that had floated at the time called Lake House. And I knew the former owner of Lake House. And ironically, they had appointed the chief exec who had worked for me at Mears and had sacked him. Sorry, he had resigned from the board. And when I initially stepped down as chief exec, I brought him in. And they brought the guy in and they floated it. And they floated on a good multiple. And the guy who ran it asked me, what did I think of it? I said, well, I just think the job at Mears was too big for him. But in reality, I don't have anything wrong with him personally. If you get on with him and you can see, get on with it. Anyway, they got it. And it became evident that very quickly that, so they'd floated, I can't remember the numbers, but they'd floated at something like £150 or £150 billion, I can't remember which, September year end. So when they put the numbers out in January for the year, they hit their numbers for the first year. Within a month, they issued a profit warning. How does it? A month, 6 weeks later, second profit warning. And a month, 6 weeks later, third profit warning. So it was obvious that the numbers they put out for the first year were, at best, adventurous. And certainly didn't look good going forward. I got approached by shareholders, in fact, by the founder. Now, without wishing to blow smoke up my own backside, this is a sector I am A, well known in, and B, highly regarded, and I suppose seen as the kiddie So it wasn't difficult that who would they come to. So Stephen came to me, would you consider coming in? Not really. Why would I want to come in and do that? Well, if I pay you that money, I don't think so. Shareholders came to me and approached me, and we agreed a deal for them to pay me a lot of money to sort it out. And it was interesting because literally, well, on morning one, 5 minutes in, I said to the finance director, when you, in quotes, interviewed me and we met, you said you had a list of 70 or 80 people you should go. That's right, yeah. Have they gone? No. Why? Oh, we waited for you to come. Right, okay, get the list. Get the HR director up and, you know, 5 minutes, let's sit down. So by 8:15, and he said, well, the difficulty is the HR director's on the list. That's not a problem, is it? So she came in, look, we've got a list of people, 78 people we feel need to go, just to say you're on the list. She said, I understand that. I said, but would you, as long as you do it professionally for me, I'll look after you. She said, you'll see me being professional. She was brilliant. And so we said to her, and I said, look, it is July. Now, it was August 3rd. I remember it was because my first grandchild was born. It was August 1 or 2, something like that. And I said, September year end, I want those 70 people out of the organisation by September. So I want the negotiations to start today, and I want them out of the buildings at the end of September, because I want to start the new financial year with a clean slate. So October 1, we started with a clean slate. And then I sat down with the senior management team and said, look, I've got rid of these people based on, I didn't know them. I'm told that they were no good. I'm told that we had to move on. Mainly centre. These were all mainly centre, not operators. We've now got 3 months. We've got October, November, December until Jan 1, calendar year, not financial year, calendar year, for you to work out what you need. Because that's from January. If you feel you've got to go and hire Fred again, Frieda again, whatever, you go and do it. Because that's from Jan 1, mate. They're your numbers, not mine. At this stage, I've done my numbers. Jan 1, you did. So Jan 1 came along, and I think we got rid of another 30 people. So anyway.
It sounds to me that like by this stage, you've kind of built a reputation of doing stuff that other people probably didn't want to get involved with.
Yeah, I think I've never had a problem confronting issues. I never have taken things personal. So when people are wanting to get rid of me, you know, as happened in SureServe and in Revolution latterly, I've never taken it personally. It's business. So I understand. However, there are consequences of it. So never an issue. And off we went in Lakehouse became SureServe. Took it. I had a bit of a barney with the broker. I blamed them for floating a business that shouldn't have been floated. I blame them for putting it on the main list when it should have gone on to AIM. And I blame them for taking exorbitant fees. So we moved it from the main list onto AIM, took it down to AIM, easier regulation for anything we wanted to do, incentivized the management team. And guess what? You know, it started performing. And what I had underestimated, in effect, was the morale. How big the morale was with those businesses that remained against the businesses that had gone or the people that had gone. They'd all felt hamstrung. So again, off we went. We managed to offload a construction business that we owned just before Carillion went. Timing was good. And it was interesting. So we had a good time. The bank got back their 40-odd million. Shareholders were recovering value. I think it was 20p when I joined, and I think it was 80p when I left, something like that. So tick, tick. And off we went. And in the final analysis, the major shareholder wanted to do his own something differently than I was willing to do, so we agreed an exit. I left
away, yeah.
And that was that. And I think I was 2021, and my partner and I decided I'd have a bit of a rest. I'd get my dodgy hip sorted, and although we didn't agree at the time, I'd go and invest in some businesses. So that's what I did. I invested in a couple of businesses. And then the phone rang, I don't know, a year or so later. And I was asked to go and do Revolution.
Yeah.
And quite an interesting one, because Revolution at the time, clearly a beauty industry. I did, you were quite right in your earlier comment that I didn't have any FMCG or, in fact, beauty business experience. I'm not sure whether we said in the interview, but, you know, one of the bankers said, well, he come to that. I didn't have any experience of beauty or in FMCG. And I said to him, yes, you're right. I don't have any experience of losing 450 quid either. She replied, yes, fair comment. So anyway, so I got involved there. Which
was that daunting, getting involved, given that your kind of sweet spot was blue collar?
Not daunting at all. No, not daunting. Eye-opening, fascinating.
I can imagine the makeup of employees might probably be very different to that.
Oh, yeah.
Like maybe lots of young
300 women. Gen Z females.
Yeah.
An incredibly efficient and well-regarded second-tier management team, predominantly, well, all female, very bright females, very, very good at what they did. They're all still there. And, you know, they were probably better than some of the senior team. So went about managing Motivator. But for the first 2 or 3 months, you know, it was very difficult because you didn't have a lot of time to actually get involved in the business because, you know, you were with a regulator, an auditor, a banker, shareholder, a founder, fighting battles, I wouldn't say they weren't easy, but it was the toughest gig I've ever done, without doubt. And in the end, we had an activist shareholder in Boogan who wanted to run the business in a particular way that I wasn't wanting to do, and we had a public spat. It was great fun, I think, for the city. Daily RNSs where they said Holt's not good enough, or Holt's too old, or Holt's not got this, and me saying yeah, this, there, that, there, t'other. And you know, the highlight for me was a comment from the great journalist Oliver Shaw in the Sunday Times, who said Bob Holt and Mahmoud Kamani are like two bald men fighting over a comb, which I have to say I thought was great journalism. Anyway, in the end
Were you criticised by them for mocking them in an RNS or something along those
lines? Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah. Yeah, I was accused of bullying them, which I thought was quite amusing. I was accused of... Well, the term that they used was... The problem was I had poked the bear, which I assume was the chairman. I said, don't understand what you mean. You're a public company. You own 26% of us. And from where I sit, if you want to take control, you buy the other 74%.
Pay up, yeah.
Pay up. Don't think you're going to bully me into just doing this, that, and t'other. And clearly, the problem with that strategy from my perspective was that they had 26%, and the founders, who I was equally in dispute with, had 31%. So technically, they could always get rid of me. And they did. And that was fine too. I was sad to leave because I would prefer to stay there and see the job through. We recruited a chief marketing officer just before I left, and she was great, Ali. She's a great girl, and I think she would be a great add-on for anybody in that sector. And they've subsequently put a new chief exec in, which is fine too. You know, I'm sad to see the recent news that Elizabeth, the CFO, has stood down, because Elizabeth, in fairness, was the major reason we got relisted and the major reason we got out of the mire that business was in, because she did all the heavy lifting. She did all the hard work. And I clearly was there to lead it and to make some of the big decisions. But Elizabeth did lots of the hard work. So a lot of admiration for Elizabeth. I have no hesitation of working with her in the future.
I kind of want to go back to a point that we were talking about earlier, which is that you've often been parachuted into these pretty grim situations that most people would want to stay as far away from as possible. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's a personality thing? Do you want it a temperament thing? Is it a hard work kind of thing? What's the secret sauce?
Well, there are a number of things. One, I take being a public company director very, very seriously. And any city advisor will tell you that I am a pain in the backside on when things aren't done correctly. And I mean a massive pain in the backside. And so therefore, if I feel that somebody has abused becoming a public company director, and at Revolution I felt that, then I'm not going to sit around and see that just be nodded off and move away. So I certainly were happy to get involved on that basis. I'm not a vigilante, quite the opposite, no. But I think running a public company is a huge honour, but it's huge responsibility. And, you know, when you've got shareholders out there, you know, I mean, I was quite surprised recently when a major institution approached me to go in and be chairman of one of their investments. And in the end, it didn't work out. And he came back to me and said, the problem is, Bob, I think they just want to run it as their own fiefdom. And the problem is, Bob, you always align your return along with shareholders, don't you? Yes, I do. So again, you know, I'm having some interesting conversations as we speak. But my reward will be based on an improving share price, a return to profitability, a feeling where the bank are more relaxed and shareholders can see total shareholder return. So that fundamentally is for me. So that's I like a challenge, and I don't shy away from a challenge.
I want to press on that, because we've had a number of guests in who have been pretty well known for having very large, you know, management kind of shareholdings in excess of 30% of their businesses, and this management alignment, certainly to us, is absolutely critical, and yet we see it less and less in material ways. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's a different style of people that's coming into public companies? Do you think it's used as an opportunity to have lifestyle businesses? You know, when you see businesses that are turning over next to nothing and management taking, you know, million quid plus salaries, why has that become so much more common?
Well, I think you have to look at advisors, don't you? You know, it's wrong, isn't it? It is wrong. And, you know, it won't be on the wit of man to understand that I will be getting back into public company life in more than one instance. And I will be totally rewarded on the basis of share price performance. So I also understand that people are greedy. I understand that people, you know, rub their hands. I took the view that in one of those turnarounds, that a flotation was an opportunity for founders or for employees to rub their hands thinking, woo, whippy.
Done it, yeah.
Stop it. You know, very serious, stop it. And again, it might sound naive to some people, this. I won't have it. And I won't have it from advisors. I won't have it from advisors who allow it to happen. So I will pull them on it, and I will pull certainly the people who do it and say, no, let's rewind here. You know, if we get up to X, then there's Y in it for you. And if you get up to Y, then there's Z in it for you. So come on, let's do it.
But there's also a big difference between paid for equity and free upside through options, warrants, whatever. There's quite a big difference there, isn't there? And, you know, my view certainly is that you've got to have management teams that feel the downside of things when it's not going well, as well as, you know.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And of course, in my scenario, that's exactly the case, isn't it? That, you know, those who know me for a long time will have heard me say and mean it, that if the business doesn't perform, I shouldn't get the rewards. Not a problem. It's a fact of life. But it comes back to, you know, how I was brought up. If you don't work hard, then you don't have it. You shouldn't earn the opportunity. If you work hard, you have a chance to.
Yes.
Doesn't mean say you will. You have a chance to. But of course, you know, you go around the around life, and you see lots of people. Yeah. But conversely, that's also a look at. And this is where I've also gone on record as saying, you know, the founder of Revolution, although obviously he was moved on and the company are considering legal action against him, he should be applauded for, you know, growing a brand from relatively nowhere.
Yes.
And he's not the only entrepreneur founder to have grown a business and not worry about the profitability. So he's got, you know, he's got the size. And however, advisors put $500 million value on that. So I would question the valuation of that. But again, but that's a different model to me. That's not how I do. Yeah, I wouldn't be bringing something to market and say, oh, don't worry about profitability. I'm going to grow a brand. No. Yeah. It'll be profitable growth. So that's where I'll be coming at it.
Yeah.
The next venture.
Yeah. No, it's amazing to hear. I think one of the areas that I'm really interested in is this kind of sense of balance, right? And again, you know, kind of reverting back to some of our previous guests, There's no real such thing as work-life balance. It's kind of just intertwined. Like how sounds like you've gone through some pretty stressful kind of tough times with your career. How's that balance with family life and you know, I know you've had I think five kids. Like, how's that worked? Have you struggled with that or not?
Well, I have three sons from my first marriage, and I'm very, very lucky because I'm very close to them. One of them works in the city, one's based in the US, works in wealth management. Well, my youngest son is in health and safety, so it's completely different guys. And we're very close, we're more like mates. And, you know, they understand totally that I was building a big business in the early days, you know, from when they were much younger. And consequently, they all had a big financial settlement, you know, when they were quite young. So it's given them the best possible start in life. They're all on London flats, you know, they've all got careers. They're all, you know, so off they've gone. And I'd like to think, you'd have to ask them, wouldn't you? I'd like to think that I've always been there for them.
I mean, it's just such a different start in life to what you've had and what they've had, right?
Absolutely, but, you know, I've just been spent the weekend in Copenhagen, as I said, with two of my kids and some grandkids. And just to treat them to, you know, an experience that I had. Two weekends ago, we went to Copenhagen again, or for the first time, with Andrew's two kids and their partners. So, look, you know, kids are very important to me. You know, although I've got three kids and two stepkids, as far as I'm concerned, I've got five kids, and that'll never be any different. So, you know, I adopted them. It's interesting, my middle son in the States adopted, met a girl, married online, met her very quickly, adopted her two girls. So I immediately had two adopted American grandkids. So he's followed, you know, followed each other on that. He's subsequently got three more kids, so he's got five kids. So, look, if I look at my life in reality, what do I do outside my business? What is my friend base? It's all business related. Yes, I've still got friends from I played sport with 40 odd years ago, and I have a reunion every couple of years, every year. But predominantly, so I don't play golf. I don't have the time to play golf. You know, all my connections, if you look through my address book, it's all business related. You know, do I do other things? Of course I do, but I only usually do it with people I've worked with or had business involvement with. So, you know, it would be 99% of my time is business related. Why? Because that's what I've thrown myself into. I don't sleep very well. I never have slept very well. I sleep very badly. And so therefore, you know, you'll get an email from me at 3 a.m. People who are new coming into my environment will find it strange, thinking, oh, is he trying to impress us? But no, I'm awake, I've got things to do. Yeah. Don't try and contact me after 9 o'clock at night because I'm not good. If I'm still awake, you'll get a grumpy me. And so that's how I run my life.
You've answered mine. I was going to ask you next, like, you know, most people, and granted you're not most people, why would you be doing it anymore, right? And it seems pretty clear to me that business is your life. It is your thing, right?
It's my interest. Yeah. People are the interest, really. Building management teams, supporting them, and then building things.
Yeah.
And, you know, my new venture, which will be effectively reversing in a couple of my investments around the energy space into a shell, excuse me, will be me, you know, for the next 12, 18 months, really going for it, bringing on board probably three or four other businesses, and then looking for a chief exec. Yes. Ideally from within one of the acquisitions, if not going out to the market and bringing somebody in who's got the desire and energy to go and build a long-term business on standards that I will impart. So, you know, that will be it. And then I'll step back to exec chairman only and or non-exec chairman, and off they'll go.
Has it been harder in the last maybe 10 years as opposed to the early years to find people with maybe like similar work ethics that understand how you work, that are comfortable with? Has that been tough or not?
I don't think so. I think, you know, you work at it, don't you? You know, if I come across somebody today who doesn't have my work ethic, for example, I'm unlikely to employ them. If I see a business that, you know, isn't run on the same levels of standards of morality, of other things, I won't buy it. I'm not trying to say I'm holier than thou, quite the opposite, you know, but we need to have people on board who know, you know, you're in the trenches, right? We're all in the trenches. And again, I think some of the early lessons in Mears were David Robertson, the finance director, and I had a great maxim, which was, let's not try and force the other one, force our opinion on something onto the other one. We're too busy. David, do you want to buy this business? I quite like it. No, I don't. Fine. Done.
Done. Yeah.
Not, let's talk about it. Let's talk. No, we're too busy. Forget it. Park it. Whatever. If it comes back in future, it comes back. Forget it. And let's move on and let's do the next thing. So I can't see me venturing too far away from that as a principle. But yeah, I've been very lucky. You know, I've met the right people. I've worked hard. My first wife always used to say to me, well, you deserve everything you're getting and get because you work harder than most people. I said, yeah, but so do nurses, so do policemen, so do... So it's a matter of luck as well. There's a lot of luck who you meet, who you come into contact with. I've been very lucky. I think, you know, I have a personality which encourages people to want to follow me. And, you know, I think even now people will want to follow me into my new venture.
Next venture. Bob, I want to ask you a bit about the charity work. The Footprint Foundation, you know, that's clearly been a bigger part of your life and an ever kind of growing part of your life. How did it start? How did it come about? I know you've got a kind of an affinity to South Africa. How did all of it come about?
All right, yeah, quite different, really, because I was a great friend of Bobby Moore, the England soccer captain. When Bob died, Stephanie's widow formed the Bobby Moore Bowel Cancer Charity. Clearly, I got involved, being a friend of Bob's. And initially, we were sending out volunteers to Brazil. Bobby was good friends with Pele. And so we went out to Brazil. I sent quite a few people out on that. We'd go out to a local community, build them a school or a community centre, build them a soccer pitch, give them a soccer kit, etc., etc. Week or so back. And raise money for the charity and raise the awareness of bowel cancer, Bobby, the brand of Bobby, and of course, in the charity. And quite rightly, the Bobby Moore Bowel Cancer Fund was subsumed within cancer research very quickly, within a couple of years, I think. And just on that, the incidence now of bowel cancer in males, the statistics are staggeringly good because early detection of bowel cancer in the male has reduced the infection rate significantly. It's fantastic. And I think principally down to what Stephanie did. Cancer research picked it up. But what one of the side effects of that was they, cancer research, were not interested in these little trips to Brazil because in the nicest way, I think they wanted to focus their minds on bigger fundraising issues.
Yeah.
So I said, I'd do them. And so I formed my own charity, the Footprints Foundation. And I think my first project was in Brazil. So I took a team of people out to Brazil and we built a school or a refurbished a school in Brazil, I think. Was it Brazil? Anyway, and then we went to Ecuador where my cousin had a foundation. He had moved there. He was a journalist. He moved to northern Ecuador. And we went out there and I did some tree planting. And funded the building of a school. At this point, it all sounds grand. We're talking coppers, talking small amounts of money. Mm. Ecuador was the first time ever, and subsequent really, where I saw that money, really, to say it had no value, didn't exist almost. You know, you had a couple of quid in your pocket. You were very, very rich in northern Ecuador. Mainly it was all barter trade, bricks and the like. Anyway, did that. And my financial advisor was saying to me, set up this foundation correctly, Bob, because you're just saying yes to everybody. So James rings you, Fred rings you. Would you like to support? Yes. Obviously, I had quite a bit of money. Can't carry on like this because it's just going to be silly. And if you look at where you put your money in, some of these, you spend a lot of money on things which had no real value, Bob. So we set up Footprints, I don't know when it was, 20 years ago perhaps, and then started focusing with independent trustees and off they went. And we went from Ecuador to Sri Lanka to India, oh, wrong way around, and to Belarus post-Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. So we did projects there, building skills. And then I was asked to go and do something in South Africa in anticipation of the Soccer World Cup in 2010. Mm-hmm. And I went out to South Africa to visit something up in Benoni, which is east of Joburg. And we did a project in Benoni in east of Joburg. And we did that for 2 or 3 years. It was an orphanage. And we built something, did it a refurbishment, built an office environment for kids, etc. So did quite a lot of work there for over 2 or 3 years. And having spent 2 or 3 years in South Africa, I realized that that's where I wanted to do my foundation, because there was a great need. There's a great need globally on these things. And I saw the need and the people. I really fell in love with the people in South Africa. Although they had great needs, they weren't greedy. They weren't expecting me to do everything. They always need and want, but they weren't expecting me to change the world for them. So I started focusing then on South Africa, and I started building infrastructure. And one orphanage became three became four, five, three, four became six became eight. And I think we support something like eight orphanages now. And over the last 2 or 3 years, we have done very big projects. So we have just returned in October from building a large school block, 28 meter long, some ground up to finish in about 6 weeks. The way it has progressed is that we now employ local labour to put in the footings, so dig out, put in the footings, build up sort of 6 foot high, and then a bunch of people go out from the UK and finish it. So a bunch of artisans go out initially, finish the walls, put the roof on, do the inside, blah, 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 and then follow on with some of the soft skills. So in this instance, they had a bunch of builders go out for a week or so. Then you had two teams, predominantly females, went out and did the painting, soft skills, glazing, and those things. Worked like a dream. An absolutely fantastic project. And that's what we've done. We built a community centre, even bigger, 2 or 3 years ago. But this year we also did a feeding programme. And what we have also evolved into is a bunch of ophthalmic surgeons go out and do eye testing. And 3 or 4 years ago, we restored eyesight to 2 7-year-old kids, which was the ultimate for me. But you're in environments where, you know, they don't have glasses. So, you know, this year even, you know, October, I was out there, I saw this young girl. Have you had your test? Yeah, got my glasses, great, yeah. She said, because when I was at school, I couldn't see the blackboard. So I had to ask my friend, what does it say? And she would get told off for speaking in class.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if you think about somebody in education in the UK, how could you comprehend that a kid in class can't see the blackboard, so he's missing some of the lesson? It's just beyond belief. And yet we are there with a bunch of volunteers who pay money to go eye testing and saying, blah, 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 here's a pair of reading glasses and here's a pair of distance glasses. Talk about life changing. So again, we do all those things. We've already got, I think, 40 people registered to go out there in October 2024. We've got a project lined up, and there'll be other things. So we not only did the eye testing, and not only did we build the school, we refurbished another orphanage, and we did some community work in a squatter camp. Oh, and a feeding program. So,
how do you have time? How do you have time for all of it?
Well, I used to do it myself. I used to go out there 4 or 5 weeks a year. Well, I think it's called telephones, aren't they? And computers. Now, it's fair to say I do little.
Yes.
Little or nothing in it now, and it's more successful.
Yes.
And you've got our dedicated people, all volunteers.
That's what we're saying earlier about building teams, right?
Absolutely, it does, yeah. So, you know, again, I think they see the passion I have for these things and want to do it themselves and broaden their own horizon. Without doubt, what we do is life-changing for the people who go out there, volunteers who go out there. Speak to any one of the over 500-600 people who've gone out on a footprints project, and they will say that was a life-changing experience. Because you see poverty.
Is that open to the public to
absolutely it is. Yeah, absolutely. Anybody could go. Yesterday I had a professional lady ring me saying, Bob, da, 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 da. Can I come in October? Yes, of course you can. She said, I'm not sure what I can do to achieve. I said, believe you me, there'll be everything for you to do. It may even go in teaching. You might go in cooking. You might go in painting. Whatever you want to do, there's loads of things to do. My wife has now seconded herself to the opticians next year. She helped them when she was out there, and she loved it so much. And I mean, it's amusing at the time, and it isn't amusing. One of the ophthalmic surgeons brought this guy out of the testing area, which is a porta cabin, and I'm sat probably a cricket field away, 22 yards. And she said, Can you wave to Bob? He's waving at you.
I can't see him. I can't see him. And I'm here, so I can't see him. Back in. Yeah. Let's go back in. And then he comes out, oh, you mean...
I've got him now.
You mean that guy?
So, you know, it's simple things like that you realise you're making life-changing things for people. So it's a great thing. No great shake, doesn't cost a lot of money. I think a volunteer pays $2,500. That's it, all in. We fly him there, we feed him, we put him up in accommodation, and that pays for all the equipment and everything. So, and that pays for all the building and everything. So it works well.
Incredible. Look, Bob, I know you're super busy, so I want to leave you with two final questions and just thank you for, deeply thank you for coming in. The two questions I have are, the first one is, if you could go back and give your 18-year-old, probably in your case, 16-year-old self, one piece of advice, knowing what you know now, what would that advice be?
It would be train hard at football, you might have a chance. That would be the first thing, I think. It would be what lies ahead will be hard work. I know you're up for it. I know I'm up for it. But along the way, there will be challenges. There'll be, you know, opportunities to do well for you and your family. If you talk to my last two turnarounds, they'll tell you about a cruise liner. And I'd encourage you, and anybody listening to this, get a picture of a cruise liner and stick it on your wall. And they laughed at me at Revolution where we'd started this. Because that cruise liner is going to leave Southampton this morning. It's going to New York. And it's going to get blown off course. It's going to have headwinds. It's going to get pushed left. It's going to have push right. It's got a leader. It's got a captain who's steering it there. And believe it or not, it's going to get to New York. And that's the journey it's on. And what we're doing here, in that case, at Revolution, we're on a journey. Now, we'll put it on the wall, and every time we move forward, we'll move it along the wall. And eventually we'll get there. And these did say, so is the journey above this room? I said, well, no, it's around the building twice or whatever. But the point is made. So they'd come into my office or the boardroom and say, bloody hell, it's moved, Bob.
It's moved.
I think we all moved it back once, but that was the message. I think stick to your knitting. I've always been a good believer in stick to what you know. You know, work hard, employ the right people. If they're not right, don't stick around too long. You know, come on, and have a common goal and get your people to buy into the culture that you're trying to create. Don't fight with people. I always felt that I used to confront things, and perhaps in the early days, confront things that didn't need confronting because you know you then bring up things that don't need. But, you know, I try now not to be as confrontational as perhaps I was in the early days. I'm still an assertive manager. I'm not aggressive in terms of that.
I heard a line from you that you haven't mentioned in this interview, but you were always very good at knowing who needed a kick and who needed a cuddle.
I put it back to my sport days. Well, you know, don't get me wrong, I was no great sportsman. But I played at levels that were better, that they were better than I was. So they had a lot more ability at both football and cricket than I had. But invariably, I was the leader because I knew that he needed a kick. And when I mean a kick, I mean going up to him and grabbing him by the scruff of the neck and saying, in language a lot stronger than I'm going to use here, come on, this is not good. Let's get on with this and we're doing this. Boom, yeah, do it. But I also knew that he needed a cuddle. So I put my arm in. Come on, mate. We need to, come on. When we're doing this, you need to do that. If you get that wrong in business,
it's a reaction, right? Yeah,
you've lost, haven't you? Because if you give him a cuddle, the one who needs a kick, he carries on doing it worse. And the guy who needs the cuddle, who needs the help and support, if you give him a kick, you've lost it. So very important. And I'm sure along the way people would say, "You gave me a kick, Bob, and I probably need a cuddle." Well, yeah, of course. Sometimes you get it wrong, as I said earlier. But yeah, very important. Knowing who, and those are simple things, aren't they? Come on. But work it through and build a team. So I think, you know, I was entrepreneur on the stock market in 2005. I don't see myself as an entrepreneur. I see myself as a team builder and, you know, getting people to buy into
maybe
it.
Maybe that is the definition of
entrepreneur. Well, some people said that is it. So that if that's it, then happy to accept it.
Yeah, yeah. And then the final thing, Bob, I want to ask you is that, and you might have just mentioned it with the two girls and and getting their eyesight back, but if you could pin down one experience in your life that's you have felt is genuinely life-changing, it could be business, it could be non-business, that has left a totally lasting impression on you. Can you pin down one moment or a few moments?
Well, I think the foundation is easier, isn't it? Because you're in almost impossible situations sometimes, and you are rescuing people or providing people a platform to go on and have a life. You know, and I remember many years ago, we had a feeding program in a school, or one of the officers had a feeding program into a school. And the school was 2,000 pupils, and they had something like an 85% HIV infection rate. So 1,700, 1,800 of the kids were infected with HIV. And we were doing a feeding program, we were also doing a counseling session. And I asked, would you mind if I sat in on one of the counseling sessions? And they said, no, not at all, please come in. I said, aren't they going to find it difficult, an old white bloke, you know, coming in with some kid coming? No, quite the opposite. They'll respect the fact that you're there. In comes this girl, and she said to the counsellor, I had unprotected sex with one of the boys, and have I got HIV? And the counsellor said, well, not necessarily, but we'll need to test you. And you know, if you have, you know, brackets, it's not life-threatening anymore. Mm. You know, there are drugs that you'll get, and, you know, we'll be able to manage the process for you. Off she goes. But, you know, come back, da-da-da, we'll do the test. She went out, and I said, how on earth could that girl have unprotected sex with a kid, knowing 85% likely that she was going to be infected? And don't get me wrong, this is not coming from some naive northerner. Mm. I've lived a full life. And she said to me, Bob, I can't believe you're asking that silly question. She said she'll have gone home to her parents and said, I need some credit on my phone, or I need a new pair of trainers. And the parents would have said, go and get a fella. The only chance you're going to get to get a pair of trainers or get a phone or get food or get is to get a man. And, you know, you realise that the world is a different place than where you were brought up. So you're very, very, very lucky if you're brought up in Europe generally, but in the UK, where everything like that is, you're educated about it, and you know, there are opportunities to go out and do things. And it comes back to the earlier comment, doesn't it, about the girl who couldn't read the backboard. You think, that did surprise me, and that was only two months ago. I'm thinking, that poor kid out. How on earth has she got to where she is? And how on earth can we understand how that person is? You know, I'll shut up in a minute, but you know, I've got a soccer academy in Soweto. People say to me, Soweto, oh, you don't go there, do you? So have you ever been? No, but no. 5.5 million people. Principally not too bad.
Yeah.
I spent lots of days there. And you know, I've got a soccer academy there. Oh,
what does that mean?
So, well, talent, that's what it means. Yeah, you know, they came to me years ago. You know, quite good, don't you, boss? Well, you know, don't forget, yeah, I know a bit about football, you know. Well, are you? Yeah, well, I've never seen you. So, anyway, I bought them a franchise to go into the South African Football League. Again, no money. They go in, first year, they win the division. First year, straight in. So our youngsters get international status. And the talent, and when people say to me about South Africans, say, well, how do you cope with that, right? Well, the people you meet, I usually say, how many languages can you speak?
Sorry, what do you mean?
How many languages can you speak? Well, one and a bit of French. I rarely meet somebody in South Africa, who can't speak 5 or 6 languages, because they have to. They have to speak Sotho. They have to speak Zulu. They have to speak Afrikaans. They have to speak English. It's very rare to speak to somebody who isn't. And I know that's not just a pure measurement of intellect.
Yeah, yeah.
But believe you me, some very, very, very bright people in South Africa. Very bright.
Anyway. It's and I'm going to end on this, but it's remarkable that someone who's had such an eventful, a successful, an adventurous work career, corporate life, and the highlights that you're picking out, the things that stick in your brain, are the kind of the basic kind of humanitarian things that you've been. It's pretty eye opening. So I just want to thank you so much, Bob, for coming on. It's been a real pleasure, okay. And have a very Merry Christmas.
And you.